Well, thank you for the introduction, and for those of you who think I really moved fields, of course I did not, as you'll discover shortly in a couple of slides. It is all still flows and networks, just trying to give other names to it. Or more in a positive way putting it, finding exciting, interesting questions where the tools that I learned from doing optimization and on networks turn out to be useful for other goals. This is the more politically correct statement. So I'm going to talk about network games and quality of outcomes. I guess the sequence of three lectures, and I was trying to both do some sort of thinking about the field as it you see as developed in sort of the last 10 years, in where things stand now, trying to go through ideas or thoughts as I and others have thought about in this area, but at the same time keeping the lectures somewhat disjoint from each other, like just in case someone can't make one of them, it's not like you now have to attend the rest. So this first one, I'm going to talk about sort of basically games in networks and what kind of outcomes, and use the traditional notion of outcome in a game, which is this Nash equilibrium, which I'll define in a minute. The next one tomorrow, I'm going to switch to something that I guess a larger community is basically trying to switch, having learned a lot from The Economist making fun of us, that, okay, it's nice that you guys care about games and economic statements, but what's this focusing on Nash equilibrium when we have learned already many, many years ago that that's a stupid thing to do. So we're catching up and we're also trying to think about other notions, which is what I'm going to focus on tomorrow. And then the last lecture on Wednesday, I hope to get to some sort of one handicap in what many of us here are doing, that it's unfortunately a bit limited to a certain class of games, and I'm trying to break out of that class of games and talk about different kind of games on Wednesday, but I guess this is a little hard to explain right now having not seen the kind of games. So what am I thinking about? So I guess this is the plan for the next three lectures. So I guess price of energy is a catchy name for quantifying the quality of outcomes, and that's the plan. I'm not so sure I'm super good at using the other slide, but when it becomes handy to remember the slide, I hopefully will remember to press the proper button. Okay, so what are games in networks? I guess I mostly think of sort of these big internet-related applications, browsers, routers, servers. Dominantly what you should think of is that there's a network which is how things are kind of connected, and there's selfish behavior which it turns into a game, and maybe unlike traditional game theory or traditional way game theories talk about games, this is never ever a two-person game. They're always an n-person game for a large n, and you should think of all the browsers, all the routers, and all the participants on the web as the participants of the game here. And maybe have to remember what this does. Okay, so my main question is going to be quality of selfish outcomes, and I guess even before defining what outcome was, I certainly should point out what the quality is, and I'm going to do that in a silly 2x2 example that I just said I'm not going to use in the talk. If you take a silly version of prisoner dilemma, which is the one that's written there, in this prisoner dilemma, two people are caught for possibly committing a crime, but we don't have evidence on them. Those numbers over there, the number of months of prison sentence they're going to have to suffer. And C refers to the traditional word for it is cooperate, that is, they cooperate with each other and don't tell on each other. And they get 2 months from some side crime. If they do tell on each other, then you can convict the guy that's being told on. Apparently for 99 months, and to induce you to cooperate with the police rather than with the other co-defender, you get 1 month off for having told on your friend. Okay, so instead of 1 month, you only suffer 2 months instead of suffer 1 month in prison, and instead of 99 months, you only suffer 98 months in prison if you only tell on your friend. Okay, this is an unfortunate game in which no matter what your friend does, you're always exactly 1 month better off if you tell on him. If you guys both act on this, then you're both going to spend 98 months in prison. This is not the socially optimal outcome. And in fact, the example is really damaging from what I was hoping to do. Namely, I was hoping to claim that this Nash equilibrium, the equilibrium in which you single-handedly can't improve your own solution. Remember, this is the only state with that property. If one of you didn't tell on the other, then you can single-handedly improve your solution by 1 month by telling on your friend. So that's the only Nash equilibrium. It's infinitely worse than the cooperative solution in this case. So this is a bad example for me, and I'm hoping that on those other applications that are sitting on the other side still, some of things will not be this bad. So kind of games I'm going to talk about today are routing, network formation games. In all of the games, the primary measure of happiness is going to be either minimizing cost or minimizing response time or delay. So it's like the prisoner dilemma. There is a cost associated with your behavior, and your goal is to minimize the cost. And maybe unlike the prisoner dilemma, the natural objective function in this case is indeed is minimizing your own cost. Cooperation with that infinitely many other people who drive on the road is not usually something that occurs to most of us as we drive. Okay, so you're simply selfishly optimizing your cost. You ignore everyone else's welfare because it seems irrelevant, I guess, or not. You're not having big effect on them or something like that. Yes. Oops, sorry. Yes, so good point. And this is something I'm going to ignore for today. That is, I could think of it as a higher level mechanism design question of how to put up the rules of this game. Okay, so one way to view it, that the stop sign or not obeying the stop sign comes as a sort of big penalty. I don't know if that's why we obey it, or whether it's just casual. I don't know. Good question. But there is a bigger question of how these games should be designed, which I'm going to stay away from altogether, and I view the stop signs and red lights as part of the design of the game. Here are a bunch of games that may be good to think of. All of the feature of games with many, many players. I said network design, which is sort of designing the internet, not designing the game rules, but designing the network structure. So it's unlike what your question was. Load balancing, facility location, I came back to. These are all at the moment you should think of as motivating games without actual definition of what these games do. The kind of games that I know a lot about, and we at this point know a lot about, are so-called congestion games. And here is the example of what are congestion games. In one way, this is a pretty broad class with a lot of the examples on the previous slide falling into the congestion game class. In the other side, it's limiting. It's only a class of games, and this is what I want to get out of at the lecture on Wednesday. Today and tomorrow, I kind of convince you that this is a broad class, showing you examples that don't look like congestion games, but they are congestion games. After all, as the state is in this class. So congestion games are games where your cost, this time or delay or money, is a function of the actual cost, the congestion on certain edges. Maybe the easiest example is done here, this load balancing game or the jobs trying to go on machines. You can think of this either as you sending a job to a printer, and how fast it prints depends how many other people are using the same printer, or you can think of it as you're using some big server in the background, the cloud computing or something. If there are a lot of people using the same setup, the same server, it's going to slow down. So here the natural measure is delay. Similarly, of course, there is routing, which is the primary example I used a second ago as you're driving. You want to go from a source S to the sink P, and you can think of bigger networks if you want. Again, it's congestion-based. That is, as you drive through certain streets. Each of these streets you congest by driving that way, and your time depends on the parameters of the edge and the congestion on it. That is how many other people are driving. What's up with this? Okay. Sorry. So basic setup, there is some simple examples of some jobs or machines or cars that are making some decisions here, each of them choosing a strategy, which is either a machine or a path to drive on. They're minimizing something that has to do with the congestion. And an equilibrium, a Nash equilibrium, is a stable strategy that is a strategy where everyone chose something so that none of them can improve their own strategy. Okay, up front, an Nash equilibrium, you might not be sure a Nash equilibrium exists, especially if I didn't call it a Nash equilibrium and didn't remind you that you know it existed, because it's possible that while I change my strategy to improve my life, that makes most of your life worse, and then one of you can change it and makes my life worse, and so on, we circle around. Okay, but that's what Nash equilibrium is, an equilibrium state where we're all happy with our current strategy. There are two kinds of strategies we're going to think about, either pure strategy Nash equilibrium or so-called mixed strategy Nash equilibrium. In many, many games, pure strategy Nash equilibrium are more meaningful. If your strategy is to build a factory, then I have no idea what a mixed strategy refers to. You either build it or you don't. You can't half-time build it. But if your strategy is to drive on a certain route, then some of you, probably not me actually, use randomized strategies every morning. You don't actually drive on the very same route, but depending on your mood, you change things. I can think of that as a randomized strategy. So a mixed equilibrium is when there's a probability distribution on strategies and you repeatedly choose from that probability distribution. And Nash's theorem tells us that in this kind of mixed strategy equilibria exist. Well, I much prefer pure strategy equilibria when they do exist. There's a further distinction that may be good to say up front that I'm going to use. The more natural from game theoretic perspective are what's called atomic games. Atomic games refer to that I'm one me and I can only choose one path at a time. And when I choose that path, my whole me goes on that path. So the way to reflect is that users control one unit of flow and they choose a single path for the unit of flow. You can also say, and I'm sure the audience here would probably more sympathize with the second view, even before the talk and certainly afterwards, that there you can take the limit as the number of users go to infinity, where every user is so infinitesimally small that it's not having much of an effect on anything anymore. And those are called non-atomic games. Technically, you get to a non-atomic game by taking an atomic game, driving n all the way up to infinity, and then taking the limit. In that non-atomic game, every one of us is making selfish choices, but there's so many of us that a single person is not having an impact on the choice. So, for example, you have to be careful exactly what you mean by an equilibrium in a non-atomic game, where the definition I gave you is more meaningful with finite number of players, that is that everyone single-handedly can improve their own life. But this is the natural limit. Every single unit of flow is going what's currently on the shortest path, or every job is what's currently on the cheapest machine, because if it wasn't, then those many, many users who are using that not-so-cheap path would all feel unhappy about their choice and they all would switch. Now, every one of them switching it has no impact, but if they all switch, that will have an impact. Okay, so that's the continuous version. And in fact, in many ways, mathematically, the more nicer and cleaner version. Oops, I should have. Both are called congestion games, because in both cases, the cost depends on the congestion. The only difference is that in the second version, the congestion is a continuous variable, whereas in the top version, the congestion is a discrete variable, takes integer values only. Okay, now let me try to convince you that congestion games are at least general. So there are two classes of congestion games beyond that distinction that I normally like thinking about. The one I focused on is so-called drafting games. That is when your cost is something named delay. And in those kind of cases, congestion is bad for you. As there are lots of cars on the same road you are, you get slower and slower and slower across. this kind of congestion game goes with a congestion function and a cost function that maybe often sort of a time or delay crossing the edge that gets worse by congestion. I'm going to simply assume that it's monotone increasing with congestion. Maybe it's also nice to assume that it does so in a continuous kind of fashion, though it's usually not needed. It's only needed that it's monotone going up. And if you really like it, I can also assume it's convex. Again, none of the theorems will use that, but one could. So these are the sort of delay kind of congestion games. And they're modeling things either packet routing in internet or car routing in cars. And there is a backwards kind of congestion game that's supposed to model cost sharing. And this is where maybe cloud computing is my favorite example. Yahoo and Microsoft and all these companies are setting up these big machines in the cloud that you're supposed to use, and you're supposed to buy shares on the cloud. I'm actually not really sure of what the details are in any other company other than Yahoo, which is what we back home at Cornell have a Yahoo share. You buy some share in Yahoo and going to pay some contribution. Now, what does it cost to set up this cloud computing? There's a natural economy of scale here. The more of you guys also buy parts of the Yahoo cloud, the cheaper it's going to get for Cornell to own a part of the Yahoo cloud. So Yahoo is saying, and let's assume it for this model, is that they're going to provide as much bandwidth as we need. We're never going to run out of bandwidth. If Toronto and many other schools want to buy bandwidth, they're just going to put up more machines. But there's obvious setup costs here. So the cost is somehow monotone decreasing as the congestion increases. This is the dominant scenario here is when you think of the cost here as money, and there's economy of scale. More people, it's cheaper to serve them. And I guess one very, very simple example is if there is the clouds have a fixed cost, maybe C is the fixed cost, and X users cost you C over X. Is a very simple example, but I'm happy to accommodate you anything that has this kind of congestion function. That is, the cost should monotone decreasing in the congestion. In both cases, I'm going to care about the quality of outcomes, and I want to stop for a second, but for today, it's only really for a second of what I mean by quality of outcomes. First of all, hopefully it's clear what quality of outcome is for every one of the users. They're all minimizing this thing named either cost or delay. Lucky thing is both money and time is additive. So if you're congesting multiple elements, you have to pay for them or you're going to have to travel through them, and both time and money is additive. If you have been using randomized strategies, I'm going to assume that you're minimizing the expectation. This is a standard assumption in game theory, maybe not warranted, but maybe more problematic is what's the overall objective function. The overall objective function for today is going to be this thing named social welfare, where I simply averaged everyone else's happiness. That is, if your load on the machine or expected delay is your objective function, and there are many, many people involved, then I simply sum up everyone's load or take the average load. Average is really nice because expectation is linear. So if it was randomized, I can simply take the expectation. And this is what I'm going to do today. If you think that this is very reasonable, then I have to admit this is the standard objective function used both in most of economy, most of the econ literature, and also in CF systems. When they want to evaluate the system, this is the standard thing to do. It's not the only thing you could do. You can definitely take something that in the CS literature is called MakeSpan, that is the worst experience any human has. This has a socialist welfare kind of feel to it. Or if you think that's too socialistic, then you really want something like this, like 95% of the people having good experiences are all reasonable overall objective functions. These are less friendly with expectations. If I want to take, ignore this one here. You take this maximum. This is the worst person's expectation, the longest delay anyone else suffered. It's actually a reasonable objective function. It's not clear how you take the expectation of this, and there are two options out there. You can either take the expected experience of one person and take the maximum, or else take the maximum first and then the expectation. This is a really damaging one. And we'll come back to which one you should care about here and how bad these are tomorrow. But for today, I'm going to stick with the average, which is certainly simpler, mathematically cleaner, and is very commonly used. So we're going to evaluate the system with average experience of the users. Now, here comes the part where I was planning to admit to people that, after all, I'm still doing optimization. And hopefully, that will make you feel like you could be doing this too, because after all, this is nothing but optimization. So if you want to evaluate how well something does, how well the Nash equilibrium is in a certain outcome, then maybe the natural first thing to do is figure out what the optimum is like, and then you're going to have to compare to that thing. So I wrote down the standard convex optimization problem on what the optimum is. I slightly cheated here in that this is written in English rather than in some, or half English, half notation. So let me try to explain what I mean. So first of all, I said that there are multiple sources and sinks, and the flows go from they connect their own pairs of sources, and then I ignored it. And for the slide, there's only one source and sink. If you don't like this, then imagine that it says that Fi is a flow from Si to Pi. Okay, so these are just the flows that we wanted. User I wants to go from his source to his sink, and that's written out as a convex optimization problem. This here refers to that there's flow conservation on all the usual sinks, that indeed that flow went from source to sink, and that you can think of as a bunch of equations which I didn't write down. So this here is the standard. This is a flow, this is a convex constraint of that much flow is being carried from the source to the sink. So that's the constraint. The objective function also has a slight cheat, but a very small one. What's the cost of a solution? So I said that the cost of a solution is that every user experiences a cost, and I added up these costs. But if I write it that way, it's kind of awkward as a convex optimization problem. So I did what's written on the bottom. I switched the summation on edges and paths. That is, I thought about an edge E and all the users on the edge, and across all those users' experience on the edge, and that's what I wrote up. That is, for every edge E, there are FE users on the edge, and each of them experiencing this much delay, and I added up edge by edge. This is the very same thing as had I added up path by path, a user going through all the edges, possibly participating in one of the FEs, he adds up his own part, it's the same thing, the summation is the other way around. So again, the point is that whether I sum by users or by edges, edge E causes this much damage to the sum of all the costs. There are FE users on the edge, and they experience LE times FE penalty for being on the edge. Summed over all edges is summed over all users. Why is this nice? Because this is a standard convex optimization problem with a separable objective function on top. Very nice, very nicely used. This is maybe the one place where I'm actually using something named convex, which I didn't quite admit to you I'm going to have. I need to assume that this thing is convex. It almost wants to be convex. If this L is a convex function, surely, and even if L is monotone, it's almost convex. It's getting there. But let's assume this thing is convex. So if this thing is convex, there is a natural convex optimization function, objective functions of how you optimize convex objective function over a convex constraint, and here is what it looks like. It would tell you that that point is the optimum if and only if there isn't a direction in which it wants to get improved. Now, what does it mean, direction, in terms of this path and routing? Here is what it means. It means that I can take an infinitesimally teeny amount of flow, and imagine here is a flow that, say, half goes on one path and half goes on the other path. It's optimal if I can take a teeny amount of flow and move it in a different direction and make it better. Now, I want to make a convex objective function better. How do I evaluate whether a convex objective function got better? I'm going to have to make sure the gradient is negative. Okay, it's a teeny move, so don't worry about second order effect. If the gradient is negative, the objective function is going down, and that's what we want, or that's what we don't want. So a flow is optimal if and only if every teeny bit of flow is traveling on what's called the minimum gradient a path with minimum tall gradient. Now, what's the gradient of the path? So I have to take derivatives. And I guess, oy, I was an idiot, sorry. I'm going to go back and I meant to capture this, but I'm bad at remembering. Okay, so that was our objective function. And again, I have to take the gradient of that objective function. The variable is f of e, the amount of flow energy. And that's what's written here with the usual x, so you can more used to taking derivatives. And that's what comes out to be the derivative. Okay, so this is how you count derivatives. In case you like English explanation to derivatives, which I personally very much do, then this is the selfish part. This is what we use to evaluate if we're selfish. And if you're taking gradients, you're going to have to have an altruistic term. The x people sharing the path with you, and you're making day delay this much worse. So this is the altruistic term, which x people having that much suffering just because you went on the edge. And this is your personal delay. And if you are a good gradient optimizer, and unlike what I said, you're not selfish, you should have had that term. And a mistake you made when you were selfish that you only used that term, you forgot to use that term. Okay, that's really what it means. Okay, so what that means for those of us who like convex optimization, that the Nash equilibrium was sort of a silly selfish optimizer where the optimizer forgot about that term and optimized using this term only. Okay, so let me put that as a summary here. And this I certainly want to also capture. So Nash equilibrium is on the bottom here, is a solution, a flow equilibrium in which every piece of flow carries on a path that has minimum latency. In contrast, the socially optimal solution, which we wanted to compare to, is a similar condition where every piece of flow goes on a path that has minimum gradient. And the gradient and social and selfish simply differs by the gradient people are socially aware and they realize the penalty they cause to others, and that's the penalty term. X amount of people on the path, they delay goes up by rate of experience. Okay, this has two beautiful consequences. That's hard not to, that's probably useful to realize at this point. So one consequence that the mean cost is Nash too. After all, the condition on the mean cost and Nash are so syntactically identical. All you have to make sure they realize that altruistic term. So if they're not so altruistic on their own, maybe you can issue a penalty. If you're taxing them at that rate, then they're going to realize the term and therefore they're going to behave optimally. Consequence number one is sort of the first consequence and was known already, I don't know, mid-50s, certainly 60s, there are papers that are using this taxation trick. Second consequence, and that's the one I'm going to like more, is that it goes backwards. The Nash equilibrium is an optimum, which is going to have to figure out whose optimum it is. After all, it's a very similar condition, and I did, I figure out which function is that happens to have Lx as its derivative, and namely that's the integral. So that's the objective function we're integrating. Okay? So Nash equilibrium is minimum cost, it's just the users unfortunately were misinformed about the cost. And they thought this ugly function here is the cost. Why? Because that function happens to have a derivative that's the right thing. So they're optimizing this thing. Now, I'm slightly cheating here and maybe it's the moment to stop here to point out that I didn't cheat so much. The selfish optimizers got a Nash equilibrium, they didn't actually optimize anything. That's a local optimality condition, the one that's sitting there. It's not a global optimality condition, unless the function is convex, in which case we're okay. But look, this function likes being convex. It's an integral of something I did assume was monotone, which is why I said all I need is the monotonicity. I only need that this function here is convex, for which I only need that that function down here is monotone, and that I did assume. I did assume it was monotone. So this is indeed a convex function. I should have slipped on this. Okay, so so this actually was originally due to Beckman, who actually knew this in the mid-50s, and used it for what I kind of drove it home for, is that saying that there is a The solution of this convex optimization problem is a Nash equilibrium. In particular, a pure Nash equilibrium exists. If you're very picky, Nash actually didn't prove anything about this system because it has infinitely many users, and a Nash theorem doesn't apply in those cases. There are many reasons here Nash cannot formally be applied here. But it's a simple statement. It allows you to find the Nash equilibrium, and actually allows you to have this identity, which actually now vanished from the other slide, is that the Nash equilibrium is the optimum of this convex optimization problem. I'm also happy to use it in a different context, which I'll tell you in a minute, though for today this is going to be a weaker version of this, and I'll get you a stronger version in a couple of slides later. I can use the potential to get what I originally wanted, just not very good bands. I can get you quality bands. And the way to get you quality bands was that I wanted to tell you that, well, these users were a little silly. They're optimizing the wrong objective function. They're optimizing this phi, this potential function phi, or this integral thing, instead of optimizing the cost we actually had in mind. So in case these two functions are not so far off from each other, so for example, if we were to know that this phi function, which was the silly integral thing, and actual cost only differ by a factor of a, then we can easily conclude that, you know, the optimizing function that's off by a factor of a, so they may be getting an optimum that's off by a factor of a, is not too damaging. It's a very, very easy band. Very, very general, applies to all potential function-based games, and virtually uniformly gives reasonable but not tight bands. Okay, so one thing I'm going to tell you in a second is how good a band it gives in some examples, and then I'll show you another method that gives much tighter bands, which then I will again use also tomorrow. So what kind of bands does that give? So when this first occurred to me, I thought that, come on, this is stupid. Wrong function, no A, no bands here. But it's not that bad. So for example, if your delay is something very simple, so I took it x to the d is your delay, you can think of even simpler, x is your delay, then the total delay, that is the penalty function we actually counted, is x people suffering the delay. So x times x to the d, that's x to the d plus 1. That's the real cost, that's the top line. The potential function, in contrast, is the integral. What's x to the d's integral? That's x to the d plus 1 over d plus 1. It's almost the same. So for example, it says that if all delays are degree d polynomials, then the ratio between this a number, that is the mistake they're making by taking the phi function instead of the potential function, is d plus 1. Okay, if you take arbitrary polynomials, d plus 1 unfortunately can be bad, but for example, for linears, this is not so bad. D equals 1, d plus 1 is 2, pretty good. And what's worse, as it turns out, which I'll show you in a minute, do not compute that, the actual truth is d over log d, so it's not so far off from the truth. It was very easy, it's not very far off from the truth. Second, and maybe, so here is the truth in a linear functions, we got 2 and the truth is 4/3, and the truth in d degree polynomials is d times d over log d. When Tim Rofgarden and I were thinking about this, and actually at this point it's like, I don't know, embarrassingly 8 or 9 years ago, it's a long time ago, we sort of weren't that happy with this. Certainly I wasn't, I'm still not, because it goes almost linearly in the degree. So as the penalties get worse, it gets worse and worse, and we instead had this alternate version, which at the time I liked a lot better. It was a so-called cheating version, in which I took the flow at Nash equilibrium, so a different flow set, weight I between sourcing pass I, and compared to an optimum that carries twice as much flow, and I was really happy that we could prove something like this, such that the Nash equilibrium at rate r is no worse than an optimum at rate 2r. It's kind of nice because it does not deteriorate with degree. I didn't even have to make degree assumptions here. It's generally true. It's also nice because that proof still uses convex optimization, whereas something more heavily convex optimization. One way to think of the essence, which I will not show to you, of how to prove this, that unfortunately, the actual cost of a Nash equilibrium here, of the optimum for rate r, could be arbitrarily small. As the degree grows, you're making bigger and bigger mistake. But the marginal cost is pretty big at that point. And since the marginal cost is big, if you're going to have to double the rate, that's going to hit you with a big enough penalty. So by the time you double the rate, it's costing as much as the Nash cost. This was sort of nice in both, in this context, it uses a nice convex optimization trick, and also nice for explaining the rationale that I guess you're supposed to design networks that can carry that much flow, and then your network will be okay even if you let people behave selfishly. But for today, I'm going to stay with the actually evaluating networks team, that is, stay away from designing things, and point out another handicap of this potential function-based method by switching for a minute in a discrete version. So if I switch to a discrete version, which remember was called atomic, and atomic here refers to that we're each carrying one unit of flow. When I choose a path, I'm me and I chose a path, and I added one congestion to the path. In contrast to infinitesimal version, I'm adding infinitesimally small amount of congestion. Here I added one unit of congestion to a path. And you can do everything with congestion gains that way too, and almost everything carries over. There's one handicap that I'll point out in a second. So what does it mean? We used to have this potential function, and that actually was introduced by Rosenthal and Mondr in 73, probably not knowing about Beckman and certainly not thinking about the connection at the time. Potential function is a function phi that has the property, seemingly magical property, that for any one of us change our strategy single-handedly, the potential function changes by exactly as much as my happiness changed. This is really weird, because my happiness has this property. When I change, my happiness changes as much as my happiness changes. But while I change, all of you got worse off, and I ignored your function. And then it's Mike's turn to change, and now the potential function will behave like Mike. That is, the potential function will somehow know who is changing, which is really kind of weird. But if you were with us for the previous version, you're not too surprised to find that what I did, this was our function in a continuous version, and I just took a discrete analog and has exactly that property, has this discrete property, which this one had with the derivatives. The derivatives are the limits of this single person changing. This is all not very surprising given where we're coming from. So this potential function, which is the discrete analog of that integral, has exactly this property. One person changes, then my happiness changes by exactly as much as the potential function changes. You guys' happiness changes too, but we ignore that. And then someone else's turn, and that person's happiness will change by as much as the potential function changes. Actually, to be precise, this idea originally came from Rosenthal, and Wonder and Shapley went backwards and they gave a full characterization of what exactly are functions, are games that have potential functions. So really, Rosenthal is more the proper reference for this. So what happens in this discrete analog? Nash equilibria are local optima of this potential function for the same reason, or actually as a direct consequence of the definition. Easier than last time. If there's a potential function that changes as much as my happiness changes, if we didn't have a local minimum of the potential function, one of us could improve it, and that person would get happier if changed, by definition. An example, just to get you thinking of this kind of potential game, is this potential game with decreasing cost function, so economy of scale kind of function. I guess my primary example here that we used when I was originally thinking about is a network design game where everyone has some points that they want to connect. So this is maybe a virtual private network that you're building, and those dots of identical color are locations for your same company. You need to build a network. Your strategy is where you're building in the network. And I'm assuming that, as I did assume in the cloud computing story, that there is a cost for providing the link that's somehow a function of how many people are using it, and we evenly sharing. Okay, this is fair sharing assumption. Again, this turns it into a congestion game. Your cost of an edge depends on how many other people using an edge. It depends on it two different ways. First, the cost goes somewhat up as there are more people using it, and then you scale it. And again, the assumption is, and that's the economy of scale assumption, that this cost monotone goes downwards as there are more people using it. This is, again, a congestion game. Again, to get you started, there's a very, very simple, stupid example here. Is there are k people here who are sharing between two options of how to go to s to t, but this is, again, one of these sharing cost kind of games. Unfortunately, there are two Nash equilibria here. The one we all wanted to have, in which every user is smart and they're choosing this one cost edge. And unfortunately, the other guy, where they're all using the stupid edge, the k-cost edge. And what you're supposed to realize here, that unfortunately is also a Nash equilibrium. What does it mean that this is a Nash equilibrium? Well, that means that a single user can improve their life, and indeed they could not. If they only switched over there, they're still paying exactly one. So it's not two users together could improve their life, but a single user cannot. So this is not a little unfortunate. But maybe not too surprising, or it's still a congestion game. So we can play the same game we used to have with the objective function, with the potential functions as we did before. And that now came from a 04 paper with Anshlevich, Des Gupta, John Kleinberg, Tom Wexler, and also Tim. Where we say that there exists a Nash equilibrium which costs at most log k more times more than the optimum. I'm going to use the same proof technique, namely this potential function and the real cost function have some connection to each other, and I don't want to go through the arithmetic, but there is a log k multiplier between the two. Again, they're not too far from each other, but they're not identical. And then the same proof we always had before says that, well, if the user is optimizing this phi function, they log k factor off, which is what the theorem says. The only trouble is that theorem was careful to say that there exists an equilibrium rather than all equilibria have this property. Why did I have to say that? Because in order to use this theorem here or this trick here, I have to assume the users are cleverly optimizing phi, but unfortunately they're not. They're locally optimizing phi, which may or may not be actually the global optimum, probably not. So all I've proved here, or this technique wants to prove to me, that there exists an equilibrium which is good property, not that all equilibria have good property. Which, remember our example back, that's just not true. We can't prove false statements. So in order to somehow explain to you that you should care, we decided to call it the price of stability, where the name's supposed to suggest that this is, so again, the definitions between price of energy and stability is the change from the worst to the best here. That is, I took some equilibrium, it just says there exists an equilibrium with good quality. And if you want to think about it, whether you care or not, I guess you're supposed to think of this sort of as a design, this stability as a design problem, this stability as a constraint. You have to find a solution that's stable. Because if it's not stable, people are not going to stay in it. But you can basically give them hints of how to start. Whether that's reasonable in the context of network design or not, probably it is actually, but I don't know if I want to defend it. But again, the same technique, the potential function technique, this can actually give us sharp bands, but, and I won't go through the example of why it's sharp, but the bigger problem is that it's only about the best solution, not about the worst solution. And this is inherent in the system. That was the main trick, that the users are optimizing phi. In a discrete setup, they're not optimizing anything. They're locally optimizing something. So let me actually end today with, or finish today with one more idea I want to tell you, which at the moment will feel a little, I find very, this potential function thing is easy and very intuitive. The second idea I think is not particularly hard maybe, but certainly less intuitive. And this is the one thing I'm splitting between the two lectures, that is, I'm going to come back and remind you of this particular definition, in part because it's awkward, so it takes a little while to digest, in part because I want to use it again next time. So here is another proof technique that I can't even tell when it was discovered, but at the moment, at least in the current form, I'm crediting Tim Roughgarden, who certainly was the one who realized that there's a shared proof technique here. And I'll give you a bunch of references how more and more people had similar proofs. The stronger proof technique will be stronger in two different ways. It, first of all, in many cases, it will actually give the tight bond, which potentials tend not to do. And it's always about the price of energy. It's about the worst solution. It's not about the best solution. So in lots of ways, it's better when it applies. It may or may not always apply. But surprisingly, it appears to apply a lot. So here is a really awkward inequality. And this is what it's going to take getting used to. I don't know where to start this. This is the smoothness constraints. There's two parameters in it, lambda and mu. And I'll come back to what they are in a second. Let me try to help you digest these terms here. There are two outcomes, or in this case, flows. This inequality here, or this term here, without the mu in front of it, is something you should be used to from the previous slide. That's the total cost of all the delays. So f, for every edge e, there are fe people on the edge, and they're suffering this much delay, and I added up over the whole network. I did the very same thing in an optimal solution, in another solution also. F star. There are two solutions here, F and F star, and this side is very reasonable. Cost of E, F, cost of F star. What's weird is that smoothness asks you to relate to something that is not in plain English, or not in any way I can say it in English. A mixed term where the flow is taken from one thing, but the delay is taken from the other. It looks completely crazy. So if you want to think of, there's two parts of the network, F is using the left side, and F star is using the right side. And then this mixing says something that you took the flow from one side and delays on the other side. Very crazy. I don't know what this is. Like the left, it's just a totally meaningless term as best as I can tell. Improved intuition of what how I should think about it would, I think, benefit me and the larger community. But in order to help you work with it, as it turns out, we don't have to look at the summations. This is really an inequality about two numbers. Namely, this inequality is going to be true because it's true edge by edge. So what does it mean edge by edge? I look at an edge. In one flow, it has F star amount of flow in it. And therefore, the edge causes you cost this much. F star people suffer this much delay. In the other flow, there are F amount of flow in it, some other number. This is like a lot of flow. There's maybe no flow at all, whatever. I don't care. And that's how much they suffer. And then I take again the meaningless term. Take one flow, evaluate it with the other guy's delay. And I claim that this mixed term that carries zero meaning is always less than those two. And if that's true, it gives you a price of energy band. That will be the claim. Okay, that's the general claim here. So before I give you the price of energy band, my first reaction is that this is a crazy inequality, can't possibly be true. No mu or lambda makes this a true statement. Maybe many of you have shared my stupid feeling about this. So first thing, I'm going to convince you that actually, in most examples, there is a mu and lambda that makes this true. And then I'm going to show to you that that's a useful statement. Okay, so this is not a statement about a class of functions, which in my example on the next slide will be the linear functions, and two numbers, f star and f. It's a very, very simple thing, easy to check. It's either true or not true. So here is a linear function. And that's going to be the one I use. And I also, for my example, gave f and f star in ordering. You're welcome to check that if I order them the other way, it only makes inequality easier. If I order them the other way, it's definitely true. So we assumed that this delay was a monotone increasing function. And actually, as it turns out, I also have to assume that delay is never negative. That is, if it's a linear function, it starts above the origin here. So what is this crazy inequality? The crazy inequality says that the left-hand side, which is this red gadget here, okay, that's the left-hand side. I took flow F star, took the delay at the other point, and multiplied them together. That's the area of the red triangle. It's less than or equal than the first term on that side, which I'm going to simply subtract here. That's the low term that I should have taken to keep meaningful, so that term here, the extra penalty term. And what's on this F star, the F times L, that's that area. So with numbers 1 1/4 as my parameters for lambda and mu, what this says that the red area here is no bigger than 1/4 of that area. Yeah, that's a true statement. It's easy to prove for all linear functions that corner, but however you do that corner, it's at most 1/4 of the whole area. And it's also easy to imagine, I hope, which I won't prove, that if you take degree d polynomials or degree whatever polynomials, it's a very simple optimization to figure out what the cost of that corner is compared to the big area. Indeed, as this function tries to sag, that it gets more convex or more sharp up, this area gets bigger and bigger, but you can always bound it as a function of the class of function. It's an easy exercise to do so. So that's what smoothness is. It looks a little crazy, but now at least I convinced you that smoothness bands do exist and they're not so hard to get. Given a class of functions, it's an easy exercise to figure out what's true about them. Second, I'm supposed to convince you that smoothness bands are useful. Now, here I'm going to hopefully feel that by now you got used to the switching between discrete and continuous, and you let me switch to discrete because it's easier to think about it that way. So here's what smoothness would mean for discrete games. And that turns out to be actually more meaningful, just harder to prove stuff, is it? For discrete games, it means that there are two strategy outcomes, S and S star, that I'm thinking of as game strategies. And here is what I do for my funny inequality, which I left actually this time on top the flow inequality to remind you that it was the same thing. What I did, these two terms are meaningful just as they always used to. The cost of S outcomes, the cost of S star outcomes. This is what we used to have. And the mixed term all of a sudden will become more meaningful. The mixed term says that a single player named I, I'm going to sum over all the players, a single player named I switches to his strategy in S star. Everyone else stays with strategy SI minus 1, and I should have had this down here. So SI is the I person I strategy in the strategy S, and S minus I is the standard game theoretic notation to everyone other than user I. And what this means here is everyone other than user I stays with S, and the one person stays with S star. This is a lot more meaningful when you suddenly realize that it will have to do with Nash equilibrium and optimality. This is the kind of thing we know something about, that the Nash equilibrium, if a single person changes, he does not have any desire to do so. You also have to get convinced that the top one is pretty similar, and I guess one quick realization is that because people are so infinitesimally small, they're not affecting the delay function when they switch, which is why it's a sort of cleaner inequality over there. So this is our smooth inequality for a discrete game. And I guess this time I didn't realize I will have two slides, so I repeated the important thing on the top of the slides again. Here's the picture of Tim, and this is what Tim realized. This is a recent paper appeared earlier this year, is that if something has this smooth inequality, it automatically improves the price of energy band, and it's a very, very easy proof that easily fits in this slide. He says, okay, this is the smoothness inequality. What do we want to bound? We're going to use this for S being a Nash outcome and S star being an optimal outcome, hence the notation star. Are we going to evaluate the cost? I'm going to write the cost in a slightly awkward way. We assume this linear cost function. This is user I using his strategy and everyone else using some other strategy that they're using. We know that it's Nash, so if they were single-handedly to switch to the optimal strategy, they wouldn't get any better. It's Nash. Now we have the term that smoothness has on the left-hand side. In fact, suddenly you realize why on earth we cared about that term. And we use the smooth inequality, and then we're all set. Look at the beginning and the end. All we have to do is rearrange terms. So cost S is mu over, lambda over 1 minus mu. And what's magical, and to me, close to unbelievable, I didn't have that here, so I'm going to stop that sentence. You can use this in the continuous games with that band I gave you. You can use it in discrete games, such as non-atomic smoothness games. The function is a little bit more awkward in the atomic version, because in atomic version, I have to have an inequality of this sort. The only thing I want you to notice is this plus one here. If I switch my strategy alone, I'm probably going to have one extra extra users on the F, take the original flow plus me. That's one. And that makes it a little bit more awkward, and the base inequality for something linear comes out to be some, again, some easy quadratic thing, pretty easy to check. What's nice and that, is that somehow, as it turns out, the smoothness inequalities were implicit in existing proofs. So if smoothness, the 1 1/4 smoothness for linear function gives our four search band with TIM. And I don't know how to think of my our proof as smoothness proof, but there are many, many proofs after that other people came up easier or cleaner proofs of what we're doing. In particular, the Correa-Schultz-Moses proof is clearly a smoothness proof. Similarly, in case of atomic games, there's two identical papers that came out independently, Averbuchs-Azar and Epstein and Pistodolo and Kutsupias, that give type of energy bands for linear functions on discrete games. It looks kind of complicated. With hindsight, it's nothing but a smoothness argument. It's very, very clean. It's equally a smoothness argument. One's a little weaker because it's discrete. Remember that plus one that causes certain penalties. And what's magical is what Tim proved is for all congestion games, whatever band you can get out of smoothness is tight. All congestion games, all classes of functions, which I think is completely magical to me. What does it mean it's tight? If you prove a band with mu and lambda, it might not be tight because you chose the wrong mu and lambda. But if you take the best mu and lambda that gives the best band, that is tight, which I think is pretty magical. Smoothness is broader than just congestion games, but maybe as a one last minute, I'll give you another sort of example of a backward scheme. This turns out to be still a congestion game, but at least don't look like it. This game is what Adrian Veda, whose picture is up there, started to work on in, I think, Ozo by now, 8 or 9 years ago. It's called a facility location game where people choose these facilities and these markets, and I won't go through the strategies. But maybe what's interesting about this, that this is a value game, not a cost game. So here, he calls it as a competitive societies, and you have to optimize welfare in societies in the game. The strategies are these colorful players that choose a market, and the users just go to the closest market. That's the game. So one strategy change would be that the yellow player switches from there to there, and then correspondingly, whole solution rearranges itself. This is a value game. By the way, unfortunately, it's still a potential game. This is a value game, and hence a little bit different, not a cost game. But there is but if you look at Veta's proof, and I'm again copying out of his paper, it's a smoothness proof. We just didn't realize to call it that. He's taking the value and somehow bound it with this sort of mixed term, where a single user I switches the strategy. Realizes that this time it can be viewed as a difference and then rearranges terms as we did before and gets the band out of it. So the smoothness proof is very general and very nice, and interestingly, the literature was full with it. We just didn't see it. So I'm going to stop here for today and hopefully convince you that these are interesting classes of games. I hope to convince you of a couple of things and that, first of all, this sort of evaluating selfish outcome is an interesting thing. Equilibrium analysis, I think, is still fascinating, despite that tomorrow I'm going to not stay with that, and has this beautiful connection to optimization, so certainly was a tempting thing for me to do, having the right optimization background. I gave you a kind of things that have to do with potential games, namely that potential that these congestion games have a potential function. They sometimes call potential games because of this. And two facts about them, that the minimum potential solution has good quality and often has good comparison to the optimum. And I gave you at the end the smoothness band, that is smoothness provides sometimes stronger bands and applies to other kinds of games. On evaluating the outcome of games. There are many more games one can look at, but what I'm going to do tomorrow instead is what I promised in the beginning I'm going to do, start questioning why on earth we're looking at Nash equilibria. And I guess if you want to not look at Nash equilibria, I think what you're supposed to look at is some class of models of behaviors in games, like users' behaviors in games and how they found the Nash equilibrium, or maybe they didn't. And what I'm going to look at learning outcomes in games, if you don't know what learning outcome is or what learning I'm referring to, then I'm going to explain this tomorrow. If you do, then I apologize. I still will explain it tomorrow. So I both will explain what I mean by learning, give you an example of a learning algorithm, and try to tell you what kind of solutions people reach if all the users have this sort of learning style behavior. And of course, ask the same question I asked today. Suppose we're not looking at Nash, we're looking at learning. What's the quality they get that way? Okay, that's what's coming tomorrow. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have time for a few questions.
So for the value games, you need the lambdas and the mu's. One of them had a reverse sign or something? At least in the inequality game.
Yeah, indeed. That's the inequality I had. That minus that.
Yeah.
Indeed. I guess. So what I want to do is want to keep it meaningful when I rearrange terms. So I'm hoping for an inequality. So this is the whole chain of inequalities here. The value of S is, because it's a Nash, every single person can change his strategy and value doesn't get, you don't benefit when you change your strategy. So that's the Nash inequality, and that should be the mixed inequality. Comparing to two ends, I want it to be the case that when I move this over to the other side, I get a meaningful inequality. So it's a lot to be positive. It doesn't matter what the sign is, as long as it stays under one. So when I move it to the other side, I get a meaningful inequality. And I guess I wasn't actually good at emphasizing, but there's a similar, maybe most clearly technically driven requirement on mu's and lambdas on the other side that was hidden in some inequality here. Mu had to stay under one. Same reason. I'm planning to play the trick to move the things on the other side. If that changes the sign, then it gives me any comparison between a negative and positive quantity. That's not very useful. So I have to keep it of the right sign. But I guess in this inequality, because it's an upper band, positive mu's are more useful. The other one is a lower band, so negative mu's are useful. And you, yeah. So the easier thing is what you're allowed to do. Yeah.
Does it give you any doubt for the
yes. So it gives you bands. For example, if the delay is a linear function of the congestion, which may be not a good model of anything, it gives you the tight band which you can get for the linear class of objective functions. In fact, for any limited class, the degree d polynomials or anything of that form, this gives you the sharpest bands you can have on that class of objective functions. Now, one thing to observe is that in order to get any kind of band, I'm going to have to limit my class, or have to do something. Because even with polynomials that are not limited degree, the band gets worse and worse, so it's infinitely bad after a while. So for example, one standard function people like using is the standard model of MM von Kuing, 1 over u minus x for a capacity x. That has the property that as you approach u, it shoots up to infinity. For that class, you don't get any bands, it's infinite. This lambda mu band is infinite and truth is infinite. So it's giving sharp bands for all convex classes, all classes of delay function that happen to be monotone and convex in the right way. What it doesn't do is the one theorem I fleshed up as an aside, offers you something when the truth is bad. Like the worst case example for, say, MM von Q's, it's just bad, it's infinitely bad. If you're really close to the capacity, then this model predicts that selfish behavior is arbitrary damaging. And that's just a fact. You can't do better because the fact is bad. But what this other theorem does, that you actually have a remedy. If you push out the capacity a bit, it's okay. Smoothness at the moment is not willing to give these so-called bicriteria bands. But it does give the sharp bands for the truth, evaluating Nash equilibrium against the optimum. Does that answer your question, or? So it gives you the sharpest band for linear, it gives you the sharpest band for quadratic, all degree divided polynomials. In fact, any class of functions that are convex, or this x times L of x is convex. almost convex. It's always the tightest band over that class of functions. Okay.
Other questions or comments? So thanks very much for an intriguing question.
Thank you.